it's hard to be a woman. Giving all your love to just one man. You have bad times, and he'll have good times doing things that you don't understand.
America's secular creed, expressed in the Declaration of Independence, is that all men are created equal and possess certain inalienable rights. Yet our focus on individual rights often leads us to forget that as citizens, Americans have certain responsibilities too. As my guest Linda Kerber suggests, the claim that women have fewer obligations to the state than men, a claim not always borne out in fact, has often led to women possessing fewer rights than men possess in American democracy. Linda Kerber is a professor of history at the University of Iowa and a former president of the Organization of American Historians. Her most recent book is No Constitutional Right to Be Ladies, Women and the Obligations of Citizenship. Professor Kerber, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Although rights and obligations are both part of being a citizen, Americans tend to think more about the one than the other. If there were a bill of obligations in the Constitution comparable to the Bill of Rights, what would it look like?
Well, first, I think we should feel very happy that we don't have a Bill of Obligations. Be very skeptical of countries that take care to spell out your obligations to the state. So I think it's a great advantage that we don't have that list. But we do have an unspoken list that is very real and that has been forcefully imposed on all citizens by the state. Two of these obligations are negative obligations. The first, I think everybody knows, we don't think we can define what loyalty is. So we don't so much say that people have an obligation to be loyal as we have an obligation to refrain from treason. There's also another negative obligation, which is the obligation not to be a vagrant. This is an obligation you don't really know you have. It's an obligation to look as though you're working, and you don't know that you haven't fulfilled it until the strong arm of the law grabs you by the shoulder when you're hanging out at a street corner and says you're a vagrant, and we've got vagrancy laws around here. There are three more obligations which are more general and straightforward. There's an obligation to pay taxes. There's an obligation to serve on juries. And there is an obligation to serve in the military.
When the Constitution was written, and also into the 19th century, women's obligations were often understood to be different than men's. Why was this so?
When the Constitution was written, the founding generation, which was very radical in its reconceptualization of the relationship of subject to the state, throwing out the idea of king and subject, replacing it with the radical new idea of sovereign citizens, was also very conservative in maintaining in the new regime two aspects of the old regime that they thought would stabilize it. They bring into the new world their old system of slavery. They strengthen it. They establish it through the two-thirds rule in the Constitution, the fugitive slave law. And they also bring into the new state the old law of domestic relations. And that assumption provided that at marriage, the husband got absolute access to the body of his wife. Well, if you have absolute access to the body of your wife, then it seemed to follow that men would have absolute access to their property and ultimately to their will. You don't let a married woman vote because it's going to give two votes to her husband. And so women enter the new American Republic differently situated than men do.
Their primary obligation then becomes almost more to their husbands than to the state. Would that be fair?
Exactly.
Your book is filled with feisty women of all sorts. Perhaps none are feistier than two sisters after the Civil War, Abby and Julia Smith, who decide even though they pay taxes, they won't pay them. Their justification is that taxation without representation is tyranny. Where have we heard that before?
Exactly. They are absolutely wonderful. They are elderly women. They are unmarried. They pay the highest taxes in their little town outside of Hartford. And it is 1873, which is the 100th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. All around them, people are saying no taxation without representation. And they say, well, if there's no taxation without representation and we can't vote, why are we paying the highest taxes in town? So they refuse to pay their taxes. The sheriff comes and seizes their cows and takes the cows to be sold at auction on a crossroads. Abby and Julia Smith get into their wagon and have themselves drawn to the crossroads to observe the auctioning off of their cows, shaming everybody into recognition of what they're doing. And then ultimately they go on speaking tours and become something of heroines of the women's rights movement, articulating very clearly that they are being denied equal protection of the laws.
On what basis can a state that extracts the highest number of taxes from these women deny them the right to vote?
Well, it's very interesting, and it was for me a key moment of understanding the difference between our mythologies and our practice. Because after all, no taxation without representation is the key thing we teach our kids. The first political lesson that young kids learn is often circulating around the Boston Tea Party. They know when you get mad, you dump the tea in the Boston Harbor and you say no taxation without representation. What happens in the aftermath of Abby and Julia Smith's protest is that some of the early legal treatises that are just starting to come out in the 1870s start to have sections about taxation. And these sections translate, not using the legal language here, but they translate as, some people think that taxation is linked to representation. No, no, no. Taxation is part of state power and state authority. And those who live in a state have implicitly agreed to follow, to be guided by and to be under the authority of the state. And so actually, we don't live under a rule of no taxation without representation, and taxation is an imposition of state power. And I believe that that is true of all of those obligations. We like to talk about them as though they are reciprocal, but there is an iron hand in that velvet glove, and Abby and Julia Smith discovered it.
The right to vote for women finally comes in the form of a constitutional guarantee, the suffrage amendment in 1920, which gives women the right to vote, but interestingly, doesn't do a lot more. They still don't have the right to serve on juries, for example. The longest section in your book, about a third of it, yeah, is devoted to the struggle which continues for more than half a century after the 19th Amendment to put women in the jury box. What in the world took so long, and how was their exclusion justified?
I think one reason is that by the time when the vote was authorized, there were a lot of people who wanted to be sure that its impact would be very narrow. There was one thing that opponents of suffrage and supporters of suffrage had agreed on, which was that the vote for women would change the world. In fact, it doesn't, and the reason it doesn't is because it would be so narrowly construed. And it comes as a surprise to many people to find that the vote did not automatically get interpreted to mean political rights in general. In some states, for example, it needed a special act of the state legislature to permit women to serve in the state legislature. And the first woman, for example, does not serve in the Iowa legislature until 1929. In some states, where the jury service statutes were written in terms of electors, women get to serve on the on juries almost immediately. But in other states, they don't. And it will take argument and struggle and bitter fight, state by state, region by region, all the way into our own time. Very few people are aware that it is not until 1975 that the Supreme Court ruled for the first time that men's names and women's names must be put in the jury box on the same terms. And it doesn't rule until 1994 that peremptory challenges cannot be used on the basis of gender. So I think that we've underestimated how narrow the interpretation of the Voting Rights Amendment was. I think that one reason for that resistance, and it's very severe, is that in a jury, women get to judge other people. They judge men. In the attacks on women on juries, one constant theme is imagine a jury mostly or fully composed of women who will decide to send a man to the electric chair. Are you willing to live with that? So it's one thing to permit women to be part of the voice of the American people, which is what voting does. It's quite another thing to acknowledge that women's judgment might be as reliable and trustworthy as men's judgment. And I think that's the issue there.
Some have argued for a long time that one of the prime advantages of being a lady and thus being treated differently under the law, as you describe in your book, is that women, unlike men, are not obligated to military service. In legal terms, what has been the disadvantage for women in not being soldiers?
The first thing I need to say is that American draft law generally starts with an opening statement that says something like, whereas all citizens are obliged to defend the country, so that theoretically, the point has been established in American law and jurisprudence, at least since the 1920s, that should the time come that Congress wishes to draft women, it could. The theoretical grounds that people think have been reliably established are not there to protect women against a draft. Congress has not chosen to draft women, but it could. When I think about the usefulness of drafting women, I don't have any good answers. I myself resist the draft in general. I'm skeptical of it. But when you think of the draft as a metaphor for using violence in defense of the state and who is trained to defend the state, who is trained to use violence in defense of state authority, then I think it becomes much less defensible to train only one half the population to defend the state with force and train the other half of the population to be incompetent in its use. In a hearing on women in the military, Judy Goldsmith, who was then president of the National Organization for Women, observed that she thought that men who stalked women, attackers, rapists, people like that, might think twice if they realized or they had reason to assume that any woman they went after was likely to have had 6 weeks of basic training. So I think what your question raises is the large question of who do we trust to use power in defense of state goals.
Obviously, the things that you're talking about are not only of historical interest, that is, not only are they placed in the past, they're clearly issues of present concern and concern for the future as well. I wonder, in the light of that, and in light of the fact that your book can be read in part at least as being framed as a response to contemporary concerns about the constitutional place of ladies, what is the role, or what ought to be the role, of a historian in entering contemporary political and legal debates?
I think that historians have been thinking, certainly I've been thinking in this book, a great deal about the relationship of women to the state and the obligations and claims that states can make on women, the obligations that states have toward women. One upshot of insisting that women and violence didn't go together for many years was the denial of the force and extensiveness of domestic violence in our country, and a denial that women needed to be able to defend themselves. In the aftermath of 9/11, we have been thinking, had reason to think very hard, not only about the presence of violence in the world, but about the absence of American response to the attacks on and the oppression of women in Afghanistan and other parts of the world because they were not part of our vision of what went on outside the boundaries of the United States. So I think that a knowledge of American complex understandings of the relationship of women to men can help us get our bearings in the way in which we respond to issues like issues of violence abroad, to our understanding of rape as a war crime, to our willingness to include women among decision makers and possessors of power and authority in the present.
Well, Professor Kerber, thanks for visiting with us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Linda Kerber, the author of No Constitutional Right to Be Ladies, Women and the Obligations of Citizenship.
Sometimes it's hard to be a woman. Giving all your love to just one man. You have bad times and he'll have good times doing things that you don't understand. But if you love him, you'll forgive him, even though he's hard to understand.